You're listening to episode 108 of the Tennis Files podcast with special guest, ATP Pro Trett Huey.
Welcome to the Tennis Files podcast, bringing you advice from the top minds in tennis to help you improve your game. And now, here's your host, Mehrban Iranshad.
Hey everyone, my name is Mehrban Iranshad, and on the Tennis Files podcast, I interview the top pros, coaches, and experts to help you improve your tennis game. And today we have a fantastic interview with one of my favorite tennis players, Trett Huey. And I say this because I know Trett from the junior days when we played a bunch of the same tournaments together in the Mid-Atlantic section, and he is as nice and professional as they come. And he's also one of the most talented doubles players in particular that I've ever come across. He has unbelievable hands and a rocket for a serve, a lefty serve, actually. Super potent when it comes off the racket. And it really was a pleasure to catch up with Trett at the City Open this past year and watch him play with Dennis Kudla, who I've also had on the podcast. And I really appreciate that he came on the show once again. And as I'll mention during the episode, you can check out his first interview with me on way back on episode 7 of the podcast. But it was great to hear about Trett coming back from a tough time on the tour with some injuries, and he's come back stronger than ever, and he's looking great. And I had a really fun chat with Trett to kind of really pick up where we left off as far as after his interview with me way back on his progress and his ups and downs on the tour, what he's learned, and some great doubles tips as well for your game, which I always try to bring out the best information that I can from all these experts to help you level up your game. And Trett certainly provided a lot of that great information for us. And without further ado, here is my interview with Trett Huey. Hey everybody, welcome to the Tennis Files podcast. It's really an honor to be on the show again with Trett Huey, who is one of the best doubles players in the world and also a friend of mine since the junior tennis circuit days. I actually interviewed Trett on the podcast over 2 years ago and about 100 episodes ago, which is pretty crazy to think about. And it's really great to have you on again, Trett. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Oh, thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate it. I've listened to a couple of your podcasts over the last year or two now. So yeah, thanks a lot for having me. It's great to be back.
Thanks, Trett. Appreciate that. And yeah, it's always nice to hear when the actual tennis pros listen to the podcast. It's pretty cool. But to give you all a bit of a background on Trett, especially if you didn't listen to episode 7. Trett has been ranked as high as 18 in the world in doubles. He is actually partnered with a lot of great players, including Jack Sock, Max Murney, Dominic Inglot, Scott Lipsky, and Jerzy Janowicz, among many others. Trett also reached the semifinals of men's doubles at Wimbledon in 2016, which is just an incredible accomplishment. And I think even that match was really close. And it was really incredible for me to watch a player that I had, you know, played against in juniors to just really make the semis of Wimbledon. And Trett has also reached the Australian Open quarterfinals for men's doubles twice and the semifinals of the Aussie Open mixed doubles as well. Trett has 8 career titles. He is a former University of Virginia standout. He was ranked, I believe, in the top 5 in the nation in college tennis. And he was, of course, a top junior player in the Mid-Atlantic, as well as the country. And he's from Alexandria, Virginia. He is a half Filipino like me, and he is the first Filipino player to reach the semifinals of Wimbledon. So, Trett, it was great seeing you at the City Open as well. Can you kind of talk a little bit about how it felt to play at your home tournament, which you had actually won in 2012?
Yeah, it was great to be back playing the City Open. I've had some great memories playing there, obviously winning the title in 2012. That was my first ATP title and obviously something I'll remember the rest of my life, being the hometown event. I think I've gone as a fan since I was 5 or 6 years old, and I think I went every year, and I've played it almost every year the last 10, 12 years or so since I've been playing. So yeah, it was great to be back, and I can't thank Mark Ein and the tournament as well for giving me the wild card. Dennis Kudla and I got a wild card occurred in the main draw. And we were real thankful for that, to have the opportunity. And we played a good match. We lost to the Bryan brothers first round in the third set tiebreak. But yeah, it was a high-level match, and we played pretty well. So it was good. Good for me to get out there and play one of the bigger events of the summer. So that was great for me on my comeback.
Yeah, for sure, Trad. I mean, I was actually there watching you and Dennis go toe-to-toe with the Bryan brothers. And as you said, you went to three sets, played a match tiebreaker for it. I mean, against the Bryan brothers, it's really incredible, especially considering that you're still, you know, making a comeback, as we'll talk about soon. But I mean, I think you're already back, because I mean, like, playing at that level is just incredible against the Bryan brothers. As I mentioned, if you all would like, and I think you really should, you should check out episode 7 of the Tennis Files podcast, where I go more in depth with Tred about the evolution of his tennis career from the junior days up to the pros. And that's a really interesting listen for sure. So just go to tennisfiles.com/7 to check that out, or go
episode
to your podcast
seven.
App.
Congrats. You've come a long way. That's pretty good.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, it's really incredible, you know, how long it's been and that I actually survived, you know, up to over 100. But it's, you know, it's just fun for me, of course. You know, both of us love tennis, so we're still in it in different paths, of course. But yeah, and I actually re-listened to the episode earlier today too, to kind of prep. But Trett, you had really a fantastic 2016, just going so deep in the majors, and you had a solid 2017. And so I want to kind of start really with that, and with 2018, which was quite tough for you. So can you kind of talk about, like, what happened in that kind of I guess valley, I'd say, of your career?
For sure. I think 2016 was the best year of my career, for sure. Made the quarterfinals of the Australian Open to start the year, won an ATP 500 in Acapulco in February. Mm-hmm. And then Max Mirny and I made the semifinals of Wimbledon, losing a close match 4 in the fifth set to Mahut and Herbert, who went on to win the tournament. And yeah, we were having a great year. And City Open that summer, actually, I just flown in from Davis Cup. I'd played, I think, singles, doubles, and singles in the weekend of Davis Cup, and flown in 2 days before the first round match with City Open. And I guess my body was pretty tired, and I kind of went full stretch for a volley in our first round match in City Open, and felt something in my back, and I felt horrible. I mean, I could barely stand up straight, and had an MRI that week or so. We pulled out of the match. I could barely walk around for a couple of days, but had MRI and had a couple bulging discs in my lower back that were really bothering me for a couple of weeks there, and it was tough. We were top 5 or 6 or so in the race to make the year-end Masters in London, and that was always been one of my big goals and dreams to do as a professional tennis player. And maybe I came back too soon and toughed it out too much, but it was something where Max and I played again in Cincinnati and did well, and made the round of, I think we made the quarters there, and picked up some good points throughout the fall, kept playing, and I felt like I was mentally okay. I'd recovered from the injury, but I think it just took a toll on me later in the season, and the start of 2017, I think, is really when it really hit me, because I started to get injured more and more, and the main cause was obviously my lower back. And it was something, looking back on now, I don't know if I would have done it any differently, because we achieved the goal of making London that year, and it's something I'll always look back on fondly. But it was definitely something that I wish could have gone differently, but at the same time, it was the best part of my career, so I can't complain at all.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's you know, sacrifices were made, of course, to really make that one of those goals that you always were aiming for. But I'm just wondering, like, what could have been? I mean, do you think, like, looking back, there could have been some sort of different routine, or, like, I don't know, recovery routines or something like that? Or was it just purely the number of hours on court, regardless of what you did after?
Yeah, something. Maybe I could have taken care of my body a little better that year, I guess. I was a little younger and always thought, oh, I can do what I can in the gym here and there. But I've become, obviously, way more professional the last couple of years, and taking care of my body, I don't know, to warm up and cool down after practice in the match, where maybe that hurt me the years before that. But that's something you learn as a younger player. And I was always on the school of thought, if my body felt pretty good, I was fine. Why do I need to keep getting physical therapy or treatment and stuff like that? Where now that I'm older, I feel a lot more pains and nicks here and there. So it's a little easier to do that and smarter to do that. But when I was younger, I didn't never felt like anything really bothered me. And I was like, yeah, I can play through it. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
And so, Trent, you mentioned that you got, if I heard correctly, injured like a few times. So, I mean, what, like, can you kind of describe those? Like, was it, would it just be like you're playing a match and and then you feel a tweak, and then you recover, you think you recovered, and then you feel it again and again?
Yeah, it was something where I, the doctors I've seen, that was the first real big episode I had in City Open 2016, I guess. And I was completely kind of stuck with my pelvis to the left, with my lower back kind of just given out a little. And throughout 2017, it happened two or three more times where I would, I don't know, full lunge for a ball or slide for a ball, and the stability of my lower back and pelvis would kind of go out, and I'd be stuck, I don't know, with a back spasm and kind of in a different, not completely standing straight, where I wasn't able to obviously athletically do anything. So it was something where after that happened, I think two or three times in 2017, I really thought I need to do something more than just a couple weeks of physical therapy and really get down to the, I don't know, bottom of the problem and see where, how I can get this really taken care of so I can, I don't know, raise my ranking and not just kind of half practice and maintain where I was physically.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I was looking at your ITF, at least on the website, like kind of showing all your tournaments. And I mean, it looks like in 2018, around like April, that was pretty much like the last match you played for like a whole nother year, at least on the tour. So like how did you come to that decision finally to just stop playing for an extended amount of time?
Yeah, right. Well, that's where it was tough. I was still having a few good results here and there when my body was feeling good, but it was something I obviously wasn't at the peak of my powers, where I felt like I could go in, day out, all out in practice, all out in the matches. But I won the title in Cabo San Lucas, Los Cabos, in August of 2017. And then a week or two later, before US Open, kind of had some back spasms before the US Open and had to pull out before the US Open. And then that kind of just prolonged it. And I tried to rehab and I felt like I was doing well going into January of 2018 and playing Australian Open. Everything was going well, felt strong, felt the body was good. And then a month or two later, just felt like it was deteriorating and slowing me down physically, where I couldn't go all out day in, day out in terms of the work I needed to put into to feel like I had a chance to win tournaments and play well. So that's where it was tough. And I kind of stopped, is that right? End of March or start of April, I guess, in 2018. And I've seen some new doctors where I opted not to get back surgery. So it was more just 6-7 months of physical therapy and kind of had PRP injections. I've tried a bunch of different things to promote the healing and everything in the lower back, but it seems like a lot of the doctors I talk to, it's just overuse, and the torque and everything from my serve has kind of degenerated a lot of my lower back and right hip. But at the same time, that's made me a really good player over the last couple of years. So can't really complain about that, I guess.
Yeah, no, for sure. And so Trett, two follow-up questions. I mean, first off, like a more technical one, what is PRP? And then after that, how did you determine to go for full rehab and rather than surgery, and like maybe the pros and cons of each?
Yeah, I had platelet-rich plasma, where they took my blood out and spun it and for a couple hours and injected it into, I think there's 36 different locations in kind of my lower back to promote the healing and get those areas with my enriched blood would promote that area of healing and regeneration in those spots. And it's shown a lot of good research in the knee and other places, where the doctor I went to was the research, and everything's pretty new for the back, but it was something I was willing to give a try. So if it's placebo that it's helped, maybe it is, but I feel like it's helped the healing process, and I've gotten a lot more stable and stronger there. And I've been seeing a chiropractor neurologist in Atlanta a few times, and I see this guy Jacob Meyer, who I see a lot for my back, and he's done some great stuff for my body, where I feel like I've gotten stronger and become a lot better in terms of, I don't know, how I take care of my body and also what I do day in, day out to make sure I'm in the right spot physically to go out and practice hard and play hard.
Awesome, man. And so also just wanted to kind of get a sense of like regarding like full rehab versus surgery, like would surgery have like given you possibly a shorter turnaround time, or like were there any pros to that you were kind of considering, or was it clear cut that you would that full rehab was the way to go?
It seemed pretty clear cut that full rehab was the way to go, where there could have been a few complications with myocarditisectomy or any kind of surgery. Mm. But the technology's obviously gotten better, but there's always a risk of that little bit of, I don't know, athletic, but not coming back athletically as well as it was before. So that's where I didn't want to take that risk, obviously.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And so you mentioned Jacob Meyer and how he helped you to get stronger and whatnot physically. So I was wondering maybe if you could describe like what kind of stuff were you doing with him? Like were there like strengthening and flexibility exercises or like what types of things were you doing with him?
He does a lot of hands-on kind of work, like body work. And he travels with a few other players, JP Smith, primarily the last couple of years. And he's been great for me. He's helped me a lot. And he's been with me working kind of strengthening my low back and doing a lot of the strength and conditioning that I've done kind of progressing the last couple months before I came back, I guess. And I still work with him every now and then. So he's been great and he's become one of my good friends. So it's good that a good relationship when you can get along pretty well with the people you work with. So it's been exciting for me to try to make a comeback and get back to playing some big tournaments. So I'm excited about that.
For sure. Yeah, it's funny. I was looking on your Twitter today and kind of just scanning it, I guess creeping on your Twitter. But I saw there was one screenshot where somebody said, I fixed your profile and it previously said injured pro tennis player and he crossed it out. So I thought that was pretty funny. And your Twitter now very succinctly says comeback time. So it's, I don't know. I just enjoyed seeing that those posts on there. But as far as like mentally, because we talked a lot about the physicality of this such an injury, but how tough was it mentally? I mean, especially being a player who has done so well on the tour and now you're off the tour for a year and like probably watching tennis might have been tough just thinking about, man, I wish I could be playing these events. So how tough was it mentally to be off of the court during this time?
Yeah, definitely. It's tough mentally to be away from the tournaments and playing the tournaments. But I'm a big fan of tennis. I still watched some of the big matches here and there, obviously. And it's always great to see Roger and Novak and Rafa play some of the big matches. I've been a big fan of the game since I was a little kid, and I don't think that'll ever stop till never. If I grow old, I'll still be watching tennis. I love it. But watching doubles, which I've obviously been playing primarily, it was tougher for me to see some guys doing well here and there. I feel like I was just at their level a year or two ago, and they've kept progressing where I've been kind of on the sideline, not able to play. So yeah, that's obviously tough mentally. And so much of it's tough mentally coming back too, where in my mind, I think I'm really good, whereas my game is still kind of catching up to that, where I need to keep progressing on the practice courts and get a little sharper here and there. And that's something the last couple months that's been tough to deal with mentally. But it's obviously a learning experience. And for me, it's fun to actually be on the court. I enjoy it every day even more now because I realize that it's not something that I can take for granted, which is maybe I did before. But at the same time, I always felt like this was the best job in the world. But now that I was away from the game, I miss it more, which is great. So it's good to be back and playing some of the best tournaments and going to some great cities the last couple of weeks. So yeah,
for sure. And it's definitely great seeing you back and doing really well. Just one or two more questions about the comeback and the tough period. I mean, did you ever at any point, and I'm curious too, like because I'm sure other players might have felt something like this, but did you ever feel like you may not be able to play again? Did it ever come into your mind?
Yeah, for sure. I definitely thought that was a possibility. I've always been pretty positive and thought, oh, well, it's going to happen. I can do well tomorrow. I'm going to be fine. But after a few days of realizing that that's not going to happen, it's hard to deal with. And that thought, I mean, came into my mind the last year or so. What if I don't physically, what if I'm not able to physically come back and play at a high level? Would I be okay with that? How am I going to deal with that mentally? So yeah, it's something I never really thought about till the last year. And I think that's made me enjoy it and really not take it for granted when I'm on the court the last month or two. I'm loving being out there, being back and giving myself the best shot to really make a good comeback.
Yeah, for sure. For sure, man. And so like during that time when you were off the tour, which like I mentioned was about a year, I mean, what types of things were, you mentioned you're watching tennis and of course rehabbing, but like what types of things were you doing while you're away from the tour?
Yeah, I was joking with some of my friends. It was great to actually live, I don't know, what I call a normal life, I guess. I've never been in the same city for more than 3 or 4 weeks at a time. And that's probably the most most. And maybe in December in the off season, if I was at home for 3 or 4 weeks, that was the longest I've ever been in one place. So it was good to be home, be with my family, be with my friends. I got married end of last year, which was during my year off. So yeah, the time that I spent with my friends and family was really great. And I enjoyed that part, which I feel like tennis players really miss out on when they're playing and traveling all over the world. For 10 months of the year, you miss so many big family events or things you can't do. So yeah, I definitely took advantage of that and had some time with family and friends, went to the beach here and there, enjoyed my time when I could. And so that was great.
Awesome, man. And so at what point, between April 18, and April 19, approximately, did you start playing? Did you start playing on the court again? And then when did you actually feel like you were really getting back to speed?
Right, I was playing and I was thinking about coming back in January this year, and I was training hard, playing in November, December, and playing with some of the pros down in Florida. In December, I realized, yeah, I feel good physically, but my game is just not there yet, and I need to maybe take another month or two to keep practicing and get my level up a few more notches. So that was something I decided not to go to Australian Open, and then push my comeback till March or so I could practice and keep getting stronger where I can do it day in and day out. If I'm going to win a tournament, I need to win 4 or 5 matches that week, and at that time I was mentally I thought I was ready to do that, but it seemed like after a day or two I was pretty dead tired and the body needed some time off, so I needed to kind of increase my strength and ability to absorb long practices, long matches, and be okay to do it again the next day. So that was something I think was smart for me to wait until I started April, the first week of April, in where did I play? In Monterrey, Mexico.
Yep.
Yeah, so it was good for me to kind of wait till that time to play, where I felt like I could physically give it everything I have and play some good matches 4 or 5 times a week to win the tournament. So I didn't want to come back and just play one good match and feel like, oh man, my body feels terrible the next day. I don't know how I'm going to get through a practice or a match the next day. So that was something I thought was smart to do, and it worked out pretty well. So happy to be back playing kind of day in, day out, and not really worrying about getting hurt and my body giving out, basically.
For sure, Tred. And yeah, I appreciate you kind of discussing this. I know it's not always easy to talk about something that was really tough to go through, but I mean, it's pretty amazing looking at your record. I mean, within 2 months you had nearly won a challenger title in Little Rock, but can you kind of talk just about how it felt to be back how it felt to be back on the court after a year?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun playing on the court. You can always simulate some things in practice, but to get actually on the match court and play, in my mind there's nothing better. There's the adrenaline rush of kind of right before the match, during the match, and playing those points, and after the match looking back at what you could have done here, what you did there to win the match or lose the match. It's something that I'll never forget, and I'll never get any other way. I feel like that's just that rush of adrenaline and the competition. I love being out there and doing that. So hopefully I can keep rising the rankings and give myself shots at bigger and bigger tournaments the next couple months.
For sure. And also, I mean, you've played with so many different partners throughout the years. I'm sure all the doubles players do. What are some of the big differences between some of the partners you've had in terms of their games or their personalities or other things?
Yeah, it's a team game, so you have to adjust and do what you think would help the team in the best way possible. Where I've played with some of the best players, where I've played with Fabio Fognini once in Madrid, and I feel like, how can I keep him mentally engaged and into the match? But he was great. He's such a nice guy, and ability wise he's unbelievable. So we played a good match and won our first round, but lost a tough one the next day. But some of the players you play with, it's just a matter of what can I do to help them both on the court and just mentally during the match, and ease them, make them feel more relaxed, and things like that, to make the team have a better chance of winning. That's how I always look at it.
Yeah, and just looking at that particular match or that tournament, it looks like you beat Team and Kohlschreiber, which is pretty awesome. I mean, Team, got to the finals of the French recently, but that's really cool. tread. And so as far as when you're looking for doubles partners, I mean, are there certain traits that you always tend to look for in a partner? Like, do you always like have some sort of filter where maybe you see available lists and right away you're like, oh, I don't think I, you know, this guy would work for me. But then others, you're like, oh, they have this particular trait where we'd be a good team.
Yeah, not necessarily. I've always thought one of my, I guess, former coaches when I was first on, Louis Calle, coaches Jamie Murray. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the best doubles coaches, if not the best doubles coach there is. He always said the rule number one in doubles is pick a good partner. So I always look at it. If their style is kind of a big server and they're good at the net, I can adapt my style to that and play a complementary piece to that. Whereas if I play with a smaller player who's a great returner and doesn't like being at the net or doesn't volley as well as some of the other players, how can I help him and adapt my game to suit him and use our strengths against our opponents? Where you can, I feel like I'm not too set on how I play or this is the only way I play. I can adapt my game style. So I think that's helped me over the years play with different players stylistically in terms of who to play with. And if anybody's good, I'd definitely play with them.
That's awesome. And yeah, I mean, that's just a real compliment to the variety in your game and being able to adapt and having, you know, all the tools needed to complement different types of players. So that's really amazing. And, you know, one thing that I've always noticed with you, even with talking with you, watching you on the court, especially, I mean, you're very calm and very professional, very even keel. Have you always been like this, or maybe like Federer, did you ever have to kind of develop it? And did you ever have a temper or anything, or have you always been like this?
No, I think that's playing college tennis. I think I was a lot more fiery and loud on the court. But mm-hmm. when I kind of made the transition to playing professionally, I think there was, I don't know, it was one of the unwritten rules. I think it was frowned upon to be really loud and yelling, come on, here and there. I didn't want to be looked at as that young college guy that, I don't know, that was just yelling and screaming the whole time. So I think that changed my first year or two or three out of college. But I feel like I've always been pretty mentally tough and strong and had a will to win, compete. So that's obviously helped me over the years. And it doesn't matter what it is, really. I mean, I can feel like I sit down and I want to beat somebody at a crossword puzzle just as much as I want to win my match that the next day. So it's tough.
Yeah, for sure. For sure, Tread. And, you know, when we talk about your college career, you can't help but think about Coach Brian Boland, who was actually on episode 34 of the podcast. And I believe he's now with Baylor, which is definitely still strange to see given how long he was at coaching at Virginia. But is there anything that you, I'm sure you remember, but any particular words of wisdom or something that he kind of taught you that you carry to this day, which you think could help the listeners?
Yeah, I had two great coaches in college. Obviously, Brian Bowen was my head coach and Tony Breske was our assistant coach, and he's the head coach of Wake Forest now. But they helped me a ton where I went into college thinking I had kind of done my job of getting a college scholarship and I was going to get a good education and get a job. Whereas they put it in my mind that I had the ability to, if I kept getting better and working at it, I could be a professional tennis player. And I never really thought I was good enough or really heard that before. And it really pushed me. And I loved that idea where I thought, no, I'd love to do that instead of get what I think of as a desk job or a real job. And I thought if I could get good at this, I would love to travel the world and play some of the biggest tournaments. So Brian was always about controlling the things you can control. So if you were going to sleep 10 hours, how are you going to use the rest of your time? You got to plan it out, control what you can control, and let the rest take care of itself. So he was a big component in, I don't know, taking care of everything you could do to make sure you were ready and also do what you could on the court to give yourself the best shot to win.
Yeah, great stuff from Brian and also Tony. I'm curious, you know, sometimes when somebody tells you something like, oh, I think you can be a great musician, great tennis player, you know, you might think, oh, you know, they're just being nice, but you don't like truly believe it to some extent sometimes. But like, how did Brian and Tony instill that in you, that belief? Like, how did it really, how was it able to impact you and get through to you that you really could be on the pro tour? Like, what was special about their particular words to you?
Yeah, it was something that I think going in as a freshman, they always would joke with me that I had a great amount of ability. And if I just put it together and learned how to play the game, learned how to use some patterns here and there, and learn to actually play tennis, that I would be a pretty good player. I had athletic ability and had a lot of shots. I just didn't know what I was doing out there, they always joke. So it was something that studying tape and going over what I can do and creating patterns in my game to really set me apart from not just doing what I felt like with the ball. Oh, I should go here, I should go there. I had a set plan. This is what I'm going to do. This is my game plan. How can I use that to my best ability? And it was great. I think both of them obviously instilled a competitiveness in me. And having Somna Devarman, who I played doubles with in college, who was at the time the best college player maybe ever, and he helped me out a lot. He was such a good player, and really practicing with him obviously raised my level a ton. So it was great to play with him, and we went on to play on the tour together and played a lot of challengers, made an ATP final in Los Angeles in doubles, and then we got to the round of 16 US Open just a few years after college. So something that really skyrocketed my ranking and my belief in that I could make it not just to 100 in doubles, but why couldn't I make it to top 10, top 5 in the world in doubles? So that was great for me, having somebody like that who was such a good player and saw that I could be a good player and really told me that. And maybe I just didn't believe it at the time. So it's great for them to give me that belief.
Yeah, awesome stuff, Trent. And so you mentioned a couple things. You mentioned patterns, and you also mentioned that you planned out your points more and whatnot. So can you kind of talk about maybe specifically like one or two patterns that you think would be helpful that you kind of put together on the doubles court or maybe singles that really helped you?
Yeah, for sure. In doubles, especially the last 10 years or so, I feel like I've had one of the better lefty kick serves, and I've used that extremely well. And on the deuce side, I would hit a kick wide and maybe go I formation and or have the guy poach, and I would kind of move over to the left side and get a forehand or a forehand first volley, where use what I'm good at, the best serve I have basically, into kind of a forehand volley with the court spread with the returner kind of wide, or staying back and hitting a forehand, which is one of my better shots. So using that as much as I can, or mixing that up and on first serve too, to keep the guy guessing and not just looking for my sliced tee serve in the deuce. Mm-hmm. And same thing that basically, so many people expect the lefty to just hit a lefty slider out wide in the ad court, mm-hmm. whereas I would use my kick tee a lot or flat tee a lot to open that wide serve, where if I only go wide, they're inching that way, moving that way, and they're a lot more ready for it, especially on bigger points. Whereas if I do go tee and kick tee in the ad court, it opens that up a little and keeps them on their toes of where I'm going to go bigger points, instead of primarily going wide with that lefty slice serve and them being on it more and more as the match progresses.
Thanks for that. That's actually very interesting insight into patterns of doubles there. Appreciate it. And as far as planning, how in depth do you go into planning how to play a match? Are you do you basically have a plan for every single game or every single point, or can you go a bit into the planning portion or aspect of tennis matches?
Yeah, the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years or so, there've been more readily available to get the video of matches. So my partner and I would go over video of the team we play and talk about their strengths and weaknesses, mm-hmm. and also talk about what we think we can do to give ourselves the best shot of winning a lot of the points, what we can do on our serve, where we should serve primarily, what we can do with return games, or if you see something, their backhand volley is a little weaker, maybe the chances we have a shot to go after a baseline forehand or backhand, maybe pick that side of the court, that person's backhand volley, to give ourselves as many points as we can that we think we'd be favored. So that's where we always try to look at as a team, and then go over the video of our previous matches too, how we can play better, how we can do better positioning wise on the court, and just get better in general as a team together.
Awesome. Great stuff, Trent. Also kind of going back to the physical side, after that, you know, that what happened as far as your back injury. Is there anything in particular that you changed, like in your routines or anything like that, like as a result of either the injury or just like kind of over the years?
Yeah, over the years, I'd say the last 3 or 4 years now, I've not lifting weights near as much, where I'm doing a lot of kind of band work. It's heavy band work. So it's, I mean, not that I'm not lifting any weights, but I'm doing a lot more of stability and kind of holding in positions with heavier bands to get my body more, I don't know, accustomed to dealing with that tension and everything to strengthen my core and everything, I don't know, in my mid body, so I can deal with the pressures of landing on my serve and kind of running and sliding all over the court. So that's something I've done more and more the last couple of years. But it's tough. We're in tennis. If you can get a good lift in here and there, it's hard to do and think, oh, I'm playing in a day or two, and your tennis players are playing every week basically for 10 months. So it's hard to consider yourself, oh, how can I lift to get stronger now, in terms of, oh, should I wait to do that only in November, December, or can I really do that to maintain my body during the season, during the tournaments? And that's something that I've kind of tried to find a fine line with the last year or two.
Got it. That's very cool. And so you mentioned bands, and you said you do like fairly heavy band work. I'm curious, kind of a, you know, specific question, but like what, how many pounds are like, is the heaviest you go on the bands, either that or like the color, or I don't even know if like the colors differ by brands, but like what's kind of like the resistance level or poundage that you use for that?
Yeah. Some of the bands are 100, 150 pound resistance bands, where wow. If you use it kind of with the bar, it's like so much. Actually, I've read and talked with some doctors about Tom Brady and how he only works with bands to work his quickness and stuff like that, where it's not, at first, I guess, when I was reading that, I was like, oh yeah, I do band work to rehab my shoulder and I don't know, to warm up. But a lot of the things now are more, it feels just like you're lifting kind of heavier weight, but it's more the holding of it with the heavier bands is just more stability wise. And I feel like it's done a lot for me last year or two to increase my, I don't know, core strength and get me ready to play day in and day out.
That is very cool. And so just, I know you mentioned about putting like bands with the bar, but so do you, so you basically kind of like attach the bands to like one of the bars that maybe you'd use for like bench pressing, or do you also like use bands like where you wrap it around your legs and things like that as well?
Yeah, both. Okay. But yeah, similar for warming up and stuff. I have a lot of the bands I wrap on my legs or use around a pole for my arms and shoulders to warm up, but so much of the work in the gym, I kind of do like around, yeah, similar to like a bench press bar, and use that for kind of squats, things like that, where to, I don't know, use instead of weight on the side, kind of having two bands on the side to hold those when you do some of the work.
That's really cool, actually. As far as who's on your team, I know you mentioned a couple people, but like, do you have, are you working with like a coach and a physio and a trainer, or who's on your team currently?
Now I guess my team would be just Jacob Meyer. I see him every now and then because he lives he lives in New Jersey, so when I'm back home in New York, I go see him a lot. But I also see him on the tour a lot because he's with JP Smith and some other players. So but when I travel to tournaments, most of the time now it's just been on my own, so hopefully I can keep progressing in the rankings and obviously make a little more money where I feel comfortable traveling kind of with a coach and a team again. So that's something where I got to build up to that, I think.
Good stuff, Trent. Yeah. Out of all the legends that you've played against, I mean, I remember actually on episode 7, we were talking about how, you know, when you had to volley against Nadal before, that was like, it was pretty crazy as far as like the RPMs he gets on his ball. But I mean, is there a particular player who, when you stepped out on the court again, you were particularly nervous because of how well known they are, or anything like that?
I don't think I was too nervous about how well known they are, but I was more nervous, I think, I don't know, not embarrassing myself. They always play in front of pretty big crowds and have a lot of fans, so I didn't want to go out there and have them make me look like I wasn't a very good player. So I wanted to obviously put on a good show and play well, and I'd be lying to you if I didn't say I want to go out there and beat them, so I could say, oh yeah, I beat some of these guys. And
sure.
I don't know, when you're older, you're like, oh, do you play anybody good? And be like, oh yeah, I've beaten some good players.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Who have you played against? So I know I've been looking at your record, but just to make sure, like I know you played against Nadal before, and you also played, I think, with Serena before. Have you played against Fed or Djokovic in doubles?
In the Asian league I played IPTL, I played against Roger in doubles. I played against Nadal in doubles, and that's where I played with Serena in mixed doubles as well.
Wow.
So yeah, it's some pretty big names there. It was a lot of fun playing those matches, and I actually got a win over Federer there when we played in Dubai. So it was something that it wasn't an official ATP match, but I consider it. We've only played once, and both of us wanted to win, and I won. So yeah, it's a great one to have. And yeah. I played a really good match when I played Jerzy Janowicz mm-hmm. in Indian Wells. We beat Andy and Jamie Murray in the quarterfinals in Indian Wells, and so that was a great win. And like you said, that was one of those nights. It was a packed crowd. On I think we played on the second biggest court, and it was completely packed, obviously, because of Andy, and we played a great match and won. It was something where I don't know if I was too nervous about playing against him, but I was more nervous about, yeah, there's a lot of people watching this match. I want to play well and not look like an idiot.
Yeah, no, dude, I hear you. Yeah, I remember being there, and that was just so incredible that, you know, you guys made the Indian Wells final. Very kind of strange, almost side note, but have you seen the video with Jerzy where he's like, how many times before?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's hilarious. I think I need to link up to that on the show notes. But anyways, as far as being on the tour, I mean, how hard is it financially? Because, I mean, I saw some sort of study, I think, that mentioned that like the top 150, at least for singles, you have to be like top 150 to be, you know, actually surviving financially. So, I mean, how tough is that? And like, have you seen a lot of other players kind of struggle with this and eventually like have to stop playing because of how tough it is to get prize money on the tour?
Definitely. That's something I, going in playing when I was playing Futures and Challengers my first year or two out of college, I saw a lot of the guys that I was maybe not as good as or about the same level. And you come to a point where you think, am I really doing this where I'm barely breaking even or losing money? Like, why am I doing this? And you have to have that belief of I'm on the right path. I'm getting better and better. I'm going to get to the bigger tournaments where the prize money is bigger and keep progressing kind of to make a living. And some of the people maybe quit before they've reached there that I thought had the ability to do it. And that's what's tough in tennis. We have kind of a structure where maybe 150 or so singles players are making a living, and in doubles, maybe 50, 60, 70 are. Mm. And then if you take into account if they pay for their coach, and then if they have a physio as well for their all three of their travel and stuff like that, there's a lot of expenses for tennis players. So it's a hard sell to make it if you're, just on the border, say you're 200, 300 in singles, or you're 100 in doubles, where how do you move up to really make a living and make a decent living after that, where if you keep progressing in the rankings? So I was fortunate for 4 or 5 or 6 years, I was kind of towards the top of the rankings and making a good living. And I had a team of two guys traveling with me, a coach and physio. So that had helped me a lot those years. But at the same time, it's hard if you're, I don't know, just on the borderline of what you can make and investing in yourself. If I invest more money into myself and pay for a coach and make, I don't know, half of what I would make this year because I'm paying for a coach, is that going to get me to a higher ranking next year? Mm-hmm. So that's the battle in tennis, where none of the money is guaranteed. It all depends on how you do in the tournaments to make more money. So it's hard to get people to really invest in themselves and give themselves shots at moving up the rankings. That's where I look at it.
For sure, Trent. And I get asked this a lot by fans. Is it usually that the coaches and trainers arrange to get like a percentage of the prize money during the year, or do they just do it like on some sort of hourly or salary basis, or does it vary?
I think it varies, but I think it's salary and then a percentage depending on what percentage that is. Or some coaches here and there, I feel like I've heard, or go on just a larger percentage and no salary, and just show that the player, yeah, I really believe in you, we're going to move up. And if they have a higher percentage of the earnings, they are way more invested in that player, obviously doing well the next, I don't know, a few months or a year when they're with them. But that's where it's hard in tennis. The player is the boss, and who knows, a couple months from that time, if they're not doing so well, they can fire the coach, and the coach is out of a job. So that's where it's hard.
Yeah, wow. I mean, this coach is really taking a gamble for sure. I mean, in some cases, like if they go like all percentage, yeah. But it's interesting. Probably good gamblers as well in the casino. But as far as you mentioned, like how tough it is, to survive on the tour financially. Do you think it's possible for ATP and WTA tours to increase the prize money so that more players can make it? Do you think that's possible? Because I don't know. I was talking to somebody and they mentioned that only a relatively small percentage of the money generated by a tournament is actually given to the players. I haven't verified this, but I mean, do you think it's possible for changes to be made to help more players survive on tour?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. Mm-hmm. If you look at the tennis politics and mm-hmm. a lot of the stuff in the news this year, mm-hmm. so much of the player council, it's tough to look at tournaments and see other major sports getting close to 50% of the revenue share, whereas mm-hmm. in tennis, the Grand Slams that are making lots of money, the players are only getting 14%, where mm-hmm. the men are getting 7% and the women are getting 7%, and that's an estimate or so, but that's far below what other major sports are getting when they're getting 45% to 50% of the revenue. But that's something the players have been working with the tournaments and the council have been working to increase, and it's gotten a lot better in the last 10 years, and prize money has gone up, and the players have never been doing better than they are right now. But at the same time, it's something to get more people making a living, say 100 to 300. Mm-hmm. That's where it needs to keep increasing for those people to be making a living and give more people a chance at making a living in tennis instead of just, say, 200 people. It should definitely be more. And hopefully in the next couple of years, it'll be 300, 500, and more as the prize money increases kind of the next 5-10 years.
Yeah, no, I'm totally on board with that. Appreciate that insight there and thoughts on that. As far as the Davis Cup, so I know I'm like asking you kind of kind of controversial questions here, but I was wondering, do you plan to play Davis Cup soon for the Philippines, which, you know, I'm really proud of? And also, like, more relatedly to the previous question, do you like the new format of Davis Cup?
Yeah, actually, I missed it this year. The first our Davis Cup tie for the Philippines was the first week of April when I had not come back yet. I'd play a tournament right after that, I guess. But mm-hmm. I've played Davis Cup the last 11 years or so since I finished college, and mm-hmm. it's been a real honor. I've loved representing the Philippines and Davis Cup and all the tournaments I've played throughout the last 10, 12 years. But I'm getting ready, actually, for Southeast Asian Games at the end of this year. We'll be in Manila, so that'll be big. And the tennis event will be at the Rizal Memorial. So that's something where I've played some Davis Cup matches there, and to have the Southeast Asian Games at home will be a lot of fun. It would be a great honor for me to kind of play in front of the home fans and kind of get everybody to see tennis as, I don't know, the bigger sport that it is, because we've had a lot of great Davis Cup matches the last 7-8 years and had some great turnouts for tennis there. And there's some great tennis fans. So it's great to have so many people be supporting the game.
For sure, Trent. For sure. And then, I mean, as far as like the new format, is it something where you're just kind of thinking like, well, I guess let's see how it goes? Or like, do you think it's actually beneficial? Because I guess it's supposed to try to get more players who, you know, I guess because it's like a shorter format, like during the year. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. I think that our idea is they can get more of the top players if they change the format, and they've done that. So I guess we'll see at the end of the year if that works out.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I was a big fan of the old format, home and away matches.
Yeah.
Against certain countries. But yeah, I'll definitely give it a chance. I want to see how it goes. And like anything, over time, it needs things need to change to update it and get more fans involved and sure. interested in it. So hopefully this does that. I'm not sure it will, but I can always be hopeful and yeah. hope that. Yeah. For the betterment of tennis, it works out. So yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a great attitude about it. And the Southeast Asian Games, just looking here, I see you've racked up a lot of medals, actually. 3 golds, 4 silvers, 3 bronzes. Can you go a little bit into like the structure of the Southeast Asian Games and also like frequency? Like, is it yearly and stuff like that?
The Southeast Asian Games is every 2 years.
Okay.
But there's a team event with a singles, two singles match. matches and a doubles match, and then there's singles, doubles, and mixed doubles. So yeah, I've done pretty well the last couple of years, and that was my first competition I played out of college, I guess. Cecil Mamet got me on the Southeast Asian Games team and was able to get me to play Davis Cup that year after I graduated from college. So it's been something that's been so beneficial for me. It's been great for me to travel and play so many matches all over Asia and play and represent the Philippines in so many ways. It's been a true honor for me, and I can't thank them enough for kind of reaching out and getting me to be a part of the team and represent the Philippines in so many competitions the last 10, 12 years.
For sure, Trett. And speaking of other players on tour, like Cecil, like who are your kind of best friends on the tour, where like, you know, at a stop you'll actually spend a somewhat significant time like hanging out or talking with them?
Yeah, I feel like I'm pretty friendly with a lot of the players, but some of the American players, I guess, I played in college, like John Isner, or I've played doubles with Steve Johnson a bunch. And Dennis Kudla, who I played with last week and at the City Open, he was a little kid at College Park, Maryland, where I trained when I was 15, 16, 17 years old. So it's been good to see him more, and he's done pretty well the last couple of years. And we used to practice, I guess, when I was 17, 18, and he was 12, 13. And Francis Tiafoe was there just running around with his twin brother, watching everybody play tennis. So there have been some good players that came out of College Park and JTCC. So it's great to see both them doing well. And yeah, we always joke around when we see each other. We've played world team tennis together, Francis, Dennis, and I. So it's good to see all those guys.
Yeah, for sure. I really like all the players you mentioned a lot. Dennis is really cool too. It was fun to kind of talk to you both a bit at the City Taste of Tennis I think last Monday, and actually had Dennis on the podcast as well at on episode 65, so definitely check that out, everyone, if you'd like. And yeah, as far as doubles advice too, I was wondering how you kind of determine what formation to use on the serve, because I mean it really does help. I mean, I've had quite a few matches where, you know, in the regular formation we had trouble holding, and then we would switch it up to like the I formation and Aussie, and all of a sudden the returners would really be kind of flustered and whatnot. So I mean, how do you kind of determine what formation to use?
I think some of the time we judge it on, oh, I feel like the returner is better when he has a target, and trying to mix it up, give him different looks, and yeah, give yourself different angles too. If you serve from kind of more towards the center of the court, when you go I formation, gives you, you know, different angles to where you want to serve to in terms of their forehand, backhand. And if you go the regular kind of out wide doubles formation, I don't know, people are more ready for that and kind of see that more and more, where it's good to change it up, give them different looks to kind of keep them guessing. That's how I always look at it.
Awesome. And I'm trying to recall like the doubles matches I've seen, and maybe this is like wrong, but I haven't been seeing too much of the Australian format. Do you use that much?
No, I feel like everybody has been going either regular kind of doubles formation or I formation. That's about it, I feel like.
Okay. I guess maybe because like you don't know where the player, like if they're going to be moving or not. But with the Australian, I guess you're like, it's kind of, you know where they're going to be for the most part. So yeah, that makes sense. And as far as your return side, have you ever switched up like throughout your career where you returned, or have you always stuck on one side?
I switched up actually. When I was in college and played with Somdev Devarman, I only played the deuce side. And I did that for my first couple of years playing professionally. And then a couple of my partners were better returners, had so many right-handers, I feel like have a great backing return. And I don't want to limit them in the deuce side, where I feel like, all right, I'll play the deuce side, you be an ad side. And I'll, no, sorry, I just mixed that up. But
that's okay.
You can edit that.
Yeah, yeah, sure, sure.
But yeah, so many guys I played with were righties with good backing return, so they would play the bad side and I would play the deuce. But when I first started playing with Max Mirny, he'd played the deuce almost all his life, and I moved to the ad side, and we had some great years playing together. We played 2 or 3 years almost, and had my best year ever when I was playing the ad side, and I was returning pretty well from that side. So since then I've played kind of half-half, where depending on my partner I can play a little bit of both sides and just kind of change up how I return, where in the deuce side maybe I'll lob return a little bit more, whereas on the ad side I'll go for bigger returns and take bigger bigger cuts on the return when I get the chance.
Awesome. Great insight there, Trent. Appreciate that. And just a couple more questions. I know we've been talking for a while, and I really appreciate your time. As far as volleys, I mean, you have, you know, I think some of the best hands in the world. I was wondering if maybe you could give us like a one technical piece of advice, or really any piece of advice you can you'd like in terms of what you think might help us develop better volleys.
Yeah, for me personally, I feel like when I'm not volleying well, I try to always remind myself to watch the ball all the way to the strings, where so many times if the people you're playing against are hitting it bigger, hitting with a lot of spin, try to really follow the ball all the way to the strings and get good contact on the ball. Helps me a ton, where so much of the time I'm focused on where I want to hit the volley, how I want to hit it, and not focused on kind of just the basics of getting good contact, hitting the ball pretty clean. When I go back to that, I feel like it resets me mentally, and I kind of get a better stick on the ball because I know I'm hitting it clean and where I want to hit it on the racket.
Yeah, I really love that piece of advice, actually, because I think a lot of more players are now kind of thinking that, oh, I need to watch the ball really well up to contact on ground strokes, but I don't think as many people are thinking about that same concept on volley. So that's fantastic. The men's doubles game, I mean, it really does seem like it goes to super tie breaks so often. It's really tough, I think, and always getting to crunch time in the third set. So I was wondering if you could maybe like give us like a tip, or kind of like your mindset, like going into these super tiebreakers that will help you be successful.
Yeah, the margins are so small in doubles, where a point here or two can change it. But in the 10-point tiebreaker, I try not to think of it as the tiebreaker is over when you're down 4-1 or 5-2. And so many times you mentally think that, because in a regular tiebreaker, it seems like you can't really come back. 4-1, 5-2, you're going to lose the tiebreaker. I don't know, 7-3 or 7-4 usually. But
yeah,
in a 10-point tiebreaker, there's still a lot of points to be played. A lot can happen in the next 5, 6, 7 points. And there'll be turns of momentum and changes once, obviously, you flip sides because of the wind or the sun. So in the 10-point tiebreaker, I don't know, playing every point and not feeling like you're too far behind, because I mean, so many times you can come back from a mini break or two breaks down in the 10-point tiebreaker to kind of get it back on serve. And I feel like that puts pressure on the other team, thinking, oh, we were ahead in this tiebreaker, we should have won it already. And that I always feel like play every point till it's over, and you can always come back. I mean, I've lost matches being ahead 8-3, 9-4 before, and I always look at that and think, why can't I come back from down 9-4? So
yeah,
doesn't always happen, but you got to give yourself the best shot.
Yeah, for sure. I love that attitude. Another great piece of advice there that everybody should take to heart. So as far as your next moves, man, like what are your next couple of tourneys coming up?
I'm playing Big Challenger Vancouver nice. Next week, and then I've asked some people for the US Open, but I don't think I'm going to get in, so I'm going to try to be an alternate for the US Open in a couple weeks. So I'll be here in US Open and practicing with some of the guys, and then get ready for some of the challengers and tour events in Asia in September and October. So that's the plan for now.
Great stuff, Trent. And you know, you being as high as 18 in the world and just kind of still on the comeback, I know you'll definitely be playing a lot more majors to come for sure. And as far as do you have any favorite books or resources for tennis players that you suggest we check out that you've enjoyed?
I feel like YouTube, people, there's so many great videos on YouTube and matches on YouTube you can watch and kind of emulate. I've always been one to watch tennis, and even when I was a kid, just watch tennis and see if I could kind of emulate that and copy what the best players in the world were doing, where I would see something and just try to do it that day or the next day when I hit the court. So that's something I've always done, and I still do today, where I watch some matches or highlights from YouTube still right now.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, and I mean, with YouTube, like it, you know, a little pro tip here, if you don't know, you can click the gear button, and then you can click I think the speed setting, and then set it to as slow as 0.25, which will enable you to watch any video in slow-mo. So that's always really helpful, I think. But Trent, I mean, it's really been really a great pleasure. Well, first of all, seeing you last week at the City Open, and also just seeing you do so well on tour and see you healthy again, it's been amazing. Before I let you go, I just want to ask you this classic question, which I ask everybody. What is one key tip that you can give us to help us improve our tennis games?
One key tip. All right. I've always been a big fan of going for your shots. I mean, if you think you can hit a winner and go for your shots, don't hold back. I mean, over time, I feel like you'll get better at it instead of kind of just pushing the ball in or being safe with it. If you really practice going for a big approach shot or going for a winner, do it in the matches where practice like you play. That's the biggest thing I've always thought. So
fantastic, Tread. Appreciate that. And yeah, there's really no worse feeling than to lose a match and then, you know, feel like you didn't go for it and you just like let somebody else take control and push you around. So love that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, for sure. I love that piece of advice. But Tread, like I mentioned, thanks so much for coming on to the Tennis Files podcast once again. And I really appreciate your, you know, all the time you gave us today. And I want to wish you nothing but the best of luck. And I look forward to watching you in many more tournaments and seeing you up there beasting it against the best in the world. So appreciate it, Tret, and all the best to you.
Thanks a lot for having me. It's been we've known each other for a long time. We played in juniors, and appreciate you following me and really having this podcast, getting more people into the game. Talking tennis is always great for sport, so I love it. Thanks a lot.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Tret. All right. I really hope that you enjoyed my interview with Tret Huey. Tret, huge shout out to you. And thanks so much for taking the time out of your day to speak with me on the show and to give us a lot of great, valuable information and to give us a peek into the life and the grind that professional tennis players endure. And if you enjoyed this podcast, I actually would really appreciate it if you would leave a review for the podcast. And you can do that by going to the podcast app that you use to listen to the show and hitting the review button and then leaving a review. If you're using iTunes to listen to the podcast today, then you can go to tennisfiles.com/iTunes. Or I think they might have renamed it to podcasts, Apple Podcasts. But in any case, tennisfiles.com/iTunes works. I really appreciate all your support, and I really appreciate everybody's support for the show, and I just really hope that you're getting a lot out of it and using it and the tips within the interviews and solo episodes as well to improve your game. And I also want to leave you with a quote, as I often like to do at the end of the show, to hopefully motivate or inspire you. And today's quote is from Tim Fargo. And Tim said, "Excuses are the rocks where our dreams are crushed." Really love that quote. I think a lot of the times we are not able to progress because we make excuses for ourselves, whether that's that we don't have enough time or you don't have enough talent, both of which are pretty much always false. You can always make the time, and you will always make the time for something that you really want to accomplish, whether that's waking up earlier or taking inventory of how long you spend perhaps on social media or watching TV. And I know that you can replace some of that time with training on your tennis game or thinking about it or setting goals and things like that, more productive things in life. And of course, all of us battle through these distractions, but it's definitely very true that a lot of the times we're not progressing because we're making excuses. And what we really need to do is to take action. And with that, you can check out all the links mentioned on the show today on the interview with Tret at tennisfiles.com/108. And thanks again for all your support. And I really hope that you enjoyed this episode. And we will see you on the next episode of the Tennis Files podcast. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Tennis Files podcast. For more tips to help you improve your tennis game, visit tennisfiles.com.